again. There is a big gap between what I've got and what I've seen, and I'll never see you again.
Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today are Ann Banks and Ted Dobson, who are here to tell the heartbreaking story of their daughter's death and its aftermath in February 2012. Maura Banks Dobson of Sheffield, Massachusetts, was killed by a drunk driver who had 6 previous convictions. Her death has led her parents to push for various reforms in the months since. Ann Banks and Ted Dobson, thank you so much for joining us. So, Ann, let me start with you and ask you to give us a little bit of a background on who you are and what your life is like.
Well, I'm Maura's mother, and since 1983, I've been farming organically with horses in Hillsdale, New York. And I'm also a music teacher at Indian Mountain School in Lakeville, Connecticut, and a performer with the Kitchen Kaylee Band doing a variety of music styles.
And what is your instrument?
I play many instruments, but my main two would be guitar and mandolin.
Interesting. That's wonderful. Tell me about your relationship with your daughter.
I have one daughter, one son, and Maura was closer to me than anyone else. She was just a fabulous being, always kind and loving, and knew me better than anyone else on earth.
Ted, tell me about the accident. How did it happen? What do you know?
Well, I'll share the night because it's seared into my memory. I had just called Ann, probably I didn't, of course, know this, 20 minutes before, or not 20 minutes before, right after Maura had been killed. Because I was expecting her home for dinner, and I was watching a PBS show about the Amish, but the house felt eerie, just still. And this is really poignant. This interviewer asked the Amish woman, how do you, besides your religion, how do you keep it together? How do you keep a community together? And she said, we don't have cars. And I was sort of knocked out by that. And then blue lights in my driveway. I have a long farm-type house on the main street of Sheffield. And then 2 police cars came into my driveway and then backed up suddenly. And I went outside to see what they wanted, but I had a horrible feeling. And they wouldn't talk to me outside.
I know this is very hard for both of you, and I think it's a terribly important story for a lot of reasons. We'll take the time we need, but Ted, if you could pick it up, that would be great.
And they told me my daughter was killed in a car accident, and that's probably the most horrific, or there aren't words to describe the emotional state when you hear your...
And there's no good way for anybody to tell you this, right? I mean, you know, they can be trained up and down, but how does a police officer do that?
They, of course, they wanted to sit down, I just knew something really bad had happened. You know, I went into some kind of epileptic shock, you know, hearing this. And I think it's strange with death. There's some sort of animal instinct. You know, I didn't feel right in my own skin, in my own house prior to any of this happening. I was beyond worried. I was sort of deeply upset, like there was some, everything was just too still, you know, like before a storm. And Anne had said to me, and this is probably why I felt this way, Anne had told me she was talking to Maura and she was on her way home from a job interview and was feeling good. and that the phone had cut off. And I said, did you try to call her back? And she said, yes. And I said, well, that's odd, because where you were talking, there's reception.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys are divorced. Who was Maura living with at the time?
She was living at Ted's.
At Ted's, okay. And she was a remarkable woman. She had quite a background. Who can tell me a little bit about her?
She was always gifted. She excelled in school. She was artistic, both musical and visual art. Always got good grades. She gave the eighth grade speech at her middle school graduation and went to Hotchkiss School on an almost full scholarship for 4 years, and then got scholarship for Yale.
What was her major at Yale?
English.
Yeah.
She was a gifted singer. As I said, she had voice lessons and was the best singer at Hotchkiss. Just when she sang, people cried. People that didn't know her. Her voice was so moving. She could have pursued any avenue of growth or endeavor. Just a very kind soul. She fell in love with her nephew and spent a lot of time with him. Many late nights when he wouldn't go to sleep, they would bounce around Ted's house together and play games and look at the moon.
She had graduated from Yale, right?
Yeah, she graduated from Yale.
Uh-huh. And now she was looking for a job.
Yeah, she was working as a tutor in the Pittsfield school system and had just landed another job as a nanny for two young twins, and had found an apartment and was eager to move there.
Where was that?
It was going to be out in Otis or Beckett, mm-hmm. somewhere out that way.
These are Berkshire towns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now let's pick up what actually happened. Ted, did you want to do that?
Yeah, well, it wasn't clear what had happened. There wasn't any specific information at that point. It took a full night and part of the morning for the police to tell me exactly what had happened. And the story was complicated, convoluted. I realized that the driver, who I'm not going to just say killed Maura, murdered Maura, came from Connecticut, and had been driven right by my house on Route 7, drunk. And the way I understood from another driver who followed him, a guy named John Ott, he picked up this drunk driver in Sheffield, literally right on Main Street in Sheffield, swerving, and he thought that perhaps the guy was sick or ill, and he began to follow him, and the guy was driving very, very slowly. And then he gunned his truck, and he hit a guardrail leaving Sheffield, a bridge, and bounced off it and ricocheted and gunned his truck to 70, 80 miles an hour. John Ott, by the way, had recently moved from a Midwestern state where he was a prison therapist for inmates. So he followed Weller, and by the time Weller was a mile and a half or so out of Sheffield traveling north on Route 7, he hit a car in front of him and ran it off the road into a cornfield, took the back off another car, and then careened into the left lane.
Russell Brown.
And hit Russell Brown, who had a small Toyota or small car. I don't remember precisely what kind of car he had, other than it was small. He had borrowed his wife's car because his bigger truck, was in the shop. Anyway, he plowed up on Russell Brown's car and then went up over Russell Brown's car, and my daughter was behind Russell Brown, and he landed on the top of Maura, who saw this coming and tried to swerve to the right, and the truck landed right on top of her car, killing her instantly. John Ott, who had his boy with him, who had just come from baseball practice, got out of his car to try to do what he could, and Weller tried to run at that point.
Into the field, as I remember.
Into the adjacent cornfields. And this guy, to me, was a real hero in the sense that he tried to do what he could for Moore and realized there was nothing he could do. He called 911. Russell Brown was trapped in his car. And then he went after Weller, who made threats on his life. And
what were the threats like?
I've killed others before, and I'll kill you too.
Yeah. And because of his training as a prison therapist, Weller's a bigger guy and not a very nice-looking person. He stayed there with him. And it turns out, when I heard this story, I thought maybe it was a few minutes before the police got there. Well, it was 20 minutes before the police actually arrived, and Weller kept going further and further towards the Housatonic. They were actually going at it, not physically, for over 40 minutes.
You say going at it, what do you mean?
Going at it verbally, you know. Leave me alone. I know something terrible happened back there. Go back and, you know, see what you can do for other people. I don't need your help, that kind of thing. And John Ott described to me what happened. I realized talking to him that his life was never going to be the same again. What he saw was, you know, traumatized him. And I never had a discussion like that with anybody in my life, because he literally was able to tell me everything from my hometown to seeing the accident to pursuing Weller and actually getting the police to Weller. I got a full description of events. And I think that's what's remarkable about the accident, from the moment I called Ann and the feeling I mentioned having in the house. I think I have a pretty vivid picture of what my daughter's last moments were and what led up to it.
And I wanted to come to you for a moment and ask you how you heard the news. And then what did you do? Did you go over to the other house, or what did you do?
I was at home. My daughter-in-law, Nalise, was living with me with their, I don't know if it was just Sammy or if Eddie was born then, too, with my grandkids. And
let's set perspective here. How long ago was all of this?
February 28th, of 2012. Yeah. And my son, Ben, was working in Haiti. He was an agricultural advisor to the cousin of President Martelly down there. And so Nalise was with me, and the door opens, and Ted came in with two of my best friends, whom he had rallied to be there for me. And Ted's eyes were really red, and he just told me she was dead. And so I just started saying, "Where is she? Where is she? I want to see her." And Anne Marie was trying to convince me that maybe I'd have to wait and that they had taken her somewhere, and that I just wanted to see her then. But it was actually several days. I had to get her all cleaned up and go over her body and all that stuff. So Nalise came up to me with a glass of water, because I guess there's a voodoo custom in Haiti that if you hear terrible news, you have to have a drink of water. So she was saying, "Here, drink this, drink this." And eventually I went over to the piano and started playing, bringing in the sheaves. And I guess I stayed at my house for a while, but then within a day or so, everybody was gathering at Ted's, and I would go over there, and you know, there'd be just tons of food that had arrived and people from all over that I knew. So it was a big deal.
You both have a lot of friends in the Berkshires. I know this. People who really were angry about this. I know this maybe inappropriate, but did you ever think from the department of what if a cop had been observing all of this on the road? What if our hero, Mr. Ott, had picked up a phone and called the cops and said, you know, come and chase this guy?
He actually did do that.
He did.
He did do that, yeah. As soon as Weller hit the guardrail and gunned his truck, he called them and the Sheffield.
But he was already on the guy's tail.
He was already on the guy's tail, and the Sheffield police were just not available any sooner than 20 minutes later. And so, yeah, of course, he said to me, John Ott, that I wish I, you know, he has a lot of guilt for God knows what reasons. Like, I wish I could have caught him. I don't know how he could have caught him.
No.
Russell Brown is crippled for life. I met him several months ago in Pittsfield, said to me, you know, if I had driven my truck that day, this would have all turned out differently. I mean, you know, these people.
Why is that?
He felt that he, the small car he was driving, turned into a ramp for the giant monster truck that Weller was driving. So he felt that it would have been a more equal contest, and there was no way that truck would have been able to climb over his big Ford truck. And perhaps he's right. We'll never know, but this is what these people have shared with me.
Tell us about Mr. Brown. He's crippled for life, you say?
Yes.
What do you mean, crippled?
Well, I mean crippled. He broke every bone in his body. Yeah. Weller did. His aorta was severed. He's had to learn. I mean, he's out of a wheelchair for an hour each day. Only as of the last couple of months, he's learned to walk again. He swims. He was the manager of the Great Barrington McDonald's, and apparently he was an avid runner. A guy who enjoyed playing golf.
You said that when you went to that hearing, one of Weller's hearings, that Russell Brown arrived and was on a walker for the first time since the accident and had walked in to the hearing.
He said that he had worked the past 2 weeks because he wanted to walk in to the court that day. His speech was slurred. You know, there was trauma to his brain.
This is all incredibly important in terms of the larger subject. I hate to put you both through all of this pain, but obviously we're going to be talking about what one guy can do to a society, to your friends, the people who are around, and the question of holding drunk drivers responsible, which I know both of you are really involved in. But let's talk a little bit more about Weller. What do we know about Weller?
He's 35 years old. He's originally from Vermont, and he got two DUIs in Vermont. He had...
Driving under the influence.
Under the influence. He also had convictions and
arrests.
Well,
what had happened after he got those two in Vermont?
Well, he was a young man at that time. His first DUI was between the age of 16 and 17. My understanding was that he was required to do some community service at that point. He got his license back when he
was... Do you remember
was...
what the community service was? Do you have any idea?
I don't, and I did at another point in time,
sure,
because I was curious, but I don't recall exactly what it was. His second DUI happened when he was 19 or 20, and I think he might have done some time in detention for about a month or two. What's interesting about that second DUI is he either lost his license for several years or lost it for some other indeterminate period. But he, after that point, in his early 20s, moved to Connecticut, where he never had a driver's license, period.
He lived in Connecticut for 16 years without a driver's license, and apparently lived a mile away from the Newtown Police.
Actually, the Sandy Hook.
The Sandy Hook Police in Connecticut.
So this gets very interesting, I mean, in terms of weirdness.
Yeah, yeah.
He's living down the street from the police station in the very town where this catastrophic series of murders and mayhem and 20 children. And he's right near the police station.
Yeah, mile away.
What do you guys make of that?
We don't quite understand it because he was driving a truck that his wife owned and insured. It was a big truck with big wheels and a lift kit on it. And she had another vehicle, which she drove. And he drove this thing everywhere. He went to Springfield, Massachusetts. He had a conviction there for assault and assaulting a police officer, driving under the influence, larceny. He had also assaults.
So wait a second. I'm sorry, Ann. We had the two in Vermont.
Yeah.
Then we get to Connecticut. Does he get into DUI trouble there too?
Well, yes. Later on, there's a number of DUIs that happen outside of the state of Connecticut, but the one that I remember in 2007 in Stamford, he wrecked his truck, drove it into a swamp. A rescue team had to be called in. He was, I don't know if he was cut out of the truck, but it definitely required assistance getting him out of the vehicle. And then he proceeded to assault.
This is obviously without a license, right?
Without a license, yeah. He went on to assault ambulance people. And when he got to the hospital, he assaulted the main physician so badly that the head nurse there, who had been there for 25 years, felt compelled when this finally went to court to show up at the court and say, look, lock this guy up for a long time. I've been at this for 25 years. I've experienced a lot of people who have been intoxicated. I've never experienced anybody like him before.
He had these histories not only of larceny and assault, but being very angry and driving drunk. So he was on parole in Connecticut, and they evaluated him. They rated him according to the dangerousness of his situation, and he was rated 4 out of 5 as a dangerous person.
Well, did he do any time for that other thing in Stamford?
Yes, he did do time. He was sentenced to 5 years. He did just under 2 years time, and he got a three years conditional parole. The reason the nurse came in is he realized that Weller was a dangerous psychopath. Some of the things he did at the hospital were revolting. The nurse felt like he needs to serve every moment of that because this man's a danger to society. I've never done this before. That is, I've never come to court before to talk about someone that I've experienced at the hospital, and I've experienced many people at the hospital who have been out of their minds on alcohol.
Yeah.
This guy's in a whole different league. Yeah. And the judge and the district attorney apparently had already made a deal or thought through what they were going to do. And as I said, I think he served, to be precise, 19 months of a five-year sentence.
But in your mind, Ann and Ted, he was a guy who was never going to be able to get straight. Was that right, Ann?
No, I mean, it seems to have been a lifelong pattern. And, I was talking before about how he had gone to Springfield and been arrested there. But when it came time to convict him, there was kind of a shifting in the evidence, because when you convict someone whose other convictions are out of state, you would have to have the policeman come and testify
sure,
at court. And that way, costs time, it costs money, it's very inconvenient. So what they did was, in the Springfield situation, was to change the nature of the conviction to something they could prove there without that extra witness coming in.
Sure.
And a similar thing in East Fishkill, New York, where he had a record. He had another incident of breaking and entering in a house and drunk driving. And These were felony charges, and the assistant district attorney in East Fishkill didn't use all the evidence that was available to him from Weller's record, and he reduced the felony charges to a misdemeanor, and he got a small fine.
From the time of his crimes in Fishkill, it was 7 or 8 months before it went to court. The district attorney there, assistant district attorney there, had every opportunity to examine his record, previous record from Connecticut and Massachusetts and Vermont. It was all there. The police in Fishkill, East Fishkill, had his record within minutes. They realized that this guy was a serial drunk, criminal behavior.
And unlicensed.
And unlicensed. It was all there. You know, they locked him up for the night. And by the way, it was the same truck. This goes back 2 years ago. Is that right, Ann?
I think so.
2 years ago in East Fishkill. Same truck that he crippled Russell Brown with and killed my daughter. He was driving in East Fishkill that night.
Yeah, it was February of 2010.
So the wife had to be somewhat complicit in this because obviously they had two cars, right? Obviously you can't drive two cars at once. So there were two cars there and he was using one of these cars quite frequently. Who knows anything about the wife without getting us into libel trouble?
We know very little about her. I mean, Alan, you bring up an excellent point is, you know, she insured a monster truck. Just to give you an idea what this looked like, it, you know, jacked up several feet off the ground, well beyond your average big pickup truck.
This was the truck that he was in when he did the crime to your daughter.
Yes. You know, smokestacks that came out of the bed of the truck. You really couldn't miss the truck. You know, this was not an inconspicuous vehicle. I think that's what amazes me about being a mile down the road from his local police department, which he mentioned he had to drive by every day to get to his various jobs as a handyman. So it appears that his wife, Bridget, aided and abetted, or at the very least, enabled him to drive this truck illegally. For all intents and purposes, it was his truck. She had her own car. The only thing I know about her is that she wasn't driving the truck.
What was his work?
He was a handyman.
What did that mean?
Meant that when I called his answering machine, there was no job too big or too small for him to do.
Did either of you ever have an opportunity to speak with him or her?
I've never had an opportunity to speak with him or her, and I'll tell you I've had no desire to speak with him or her. I think the idea of talking to him had crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
No question about it, and certainly the idea of talking to her has crossed my mind as well, and I wouldn't rule it out.
If those guys had guilt, which is ridiculous, for that night, the other drivers who were heroes in so many ways. You know, the idea that her guilt, in allowing this truck to be driven. Yeah.
And not the first time that he had problems in the truck either.
So what questions, I'm sorry for stopping you, but what questions would you have asked either him or her if you had a chance to talk to them?
I have no desire to.
Okay, but you don't. So you've never had this scenario.
To her, I could just think, you know, what were you doing? I mean, like, why would you be with a person that was this horrible, you know, and provide this vehicle for him?
You know, nobody's one-dimensional in life, and I don't want to create cardboard figures of these people. And in a sense, you know, it's easy to think of this guy as a dirtbag and his wife as the same, but I know better. And I know that the guy had his own children. Perhaps he loves his own children. I'm not going to say he's all bad or the embodiment of evil. I'd say he had some terrible problems that the system overlooked and was not getting adequate counseling when he needed it for some of the things that he had done earlier on in his life. I can't comment on the relationship. When I think about Bridget, I think about what Ann just said. What are you thinking? The guy doesn't have a driver's license. He's got a miserable record on the road. Why do you have a truck for him?
Six convictions. Yeah, and we don't know what else came in between.
We don't. We do know that he committed a crime every day by just getting in the truck and driving with no driver's license.
Is she criminally responsible at all in terms of facilitating this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Has anybody done anything about that?
Yes.
What's happening?
I mean, but they had very, very little to go after. The police in Great Barrington, or Sheffield, that is, have said that given the way the laws and the statutes work, is that they really can't go after her directly. It's conjecture. I mean, so I suppose that's what we're doing right now, is conjecturing, you know. But as far as I'm concerned, is she's guilty. And she'll have her day at some point in the future to answer to it in a civil suit. Because I'd like to know what she was thinking. As far as the reality of what happened in a criminal sense, you know, Weller sitting in a jail in Pittsfield waiting for trial, she wasn't in the car with him. So she didn't aid and abet in any direct way. But in a civil sense, I think these are questions that she needs to answer.
Maybe I'm naive, but isn't it so that in a crime, if you give somebody a gun and they murder somebody, you have some responsibility for that?
I don't know if the driving laws are tight enough to mm-hmm. provide for that, and that's one of the things
you're going to go there.
Interested in. Another thing that's interesting, you were talking before, asking what Weller's community service was as a young man. Well, part of his parole stipulations down in Connecticut were that he do some kind of community service. And when asked what his community service was, he said, "I adopted a dog from the shelter," number one. And number two, he worked for the police department.
Well, he said he worked for
the
police department.
He said that. We haven't confirmed it yet.
We don't know this.
For which police department?
He was not specific. This is a part of parole records that we were able to get a hold of after Maura died. And the parole officer, Andrea Caldron, said that when asked, "Why are you violating all the stipulations of your parole?" he said, "I'm not. I am doing community service. I work for a police department." So that's just a matter of record. We've yet to find out.
Well, it could
be
very important, couldn't it?
It could be extremely important.
In terms of what the police have done or haven't done.
Yeah, if he's working as an informant or some kind of aid to the police, that's a big deal.
Let's go on. Where is Weller now?
He's in the Pittsfield jail awaiting trial. He's looking at doing some serious time in prison. State prison in our state of Massachusetts.
Well, so just as so everybody knows, this case became, you know, incredibly important to everybody in the Berkshires. It was, you know, we're talking about front page of the paper constantly, the idea that this guy had all of these DWIs, that nobody had really done anything about it, that he hadn't really changed, and he was still allowed to go and do this. It was quite a shot.
Yeah, well, I think anybody who has children realize that it could have been their child. It was completely random. It was absolutely brutal. The idea that somebody like this hadn't been stopped or prevented from driving, I think, was mind-blowing for a lot of people. This is a guy who clearly not only shouldn't have been on the road, he should have been behind bars. And when I say should have, Let's get rid of should have. That's where he was meant to be. He had violated all the stipulations of his parole. The idea that he had access to a vehicle, the idea that the guy had no driver's license, had been convicted in the past of drunk driving. How was he able to even get in a car? You know, I think so. A lot of this information surfaced quickly.
So that all of these things that we see, you know, there are these devices, you can't get into a car if you're... that's all, you know,
theory here. It has nothing to do with the reality of what was happening with this guy, and probably with a lot of other people, you know, who are doing
the same thing. It's a widespread problem. I think Connecticut has legislation to require ignition interlock devices to prevent people from driving if they are intoxicated, but they're not on every car.
And if you use your wife's car,
you can drive.
And here's a guy, and I'm sorry, who's a block away from at least one police station that we know, and we wonder whether or not, with his convictions and what his troubles, that they didn't know what he was up to, that he was driving around somebody else's car.
We do wonder.
Yeah, it's not possible for them to not know a little bit about this person.
Well, look, if it is possible that they did not know, they should be fired for gross negligence and dereliction of their duty as police officers. A police officer's duty is to protect the public and protect the community of neighbors that the station is in, first and foremost. How do you not know the people in your community as a local police officer? Mind-boggling. If it's the case that they didn't know that Frederick Weller not only didn't have a driver's license, but didn't have a criminal record around driving, what kind of police officer is that? If these police were in the private sector, they would have been fired right away.
Believe it or not, we're running out of time here. I wanted to ask you very quickly, are either of you religious people?
Not in a formal way, but I would say in a spiritual level, yes.
So, Anne, have you ever questioned what this cause and effect was here, or what happened?
I question it all the time, but I don't know if I could articulate it that well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me go to the meat of this. Six convictions that we know about, guys sitting there in jail, thank God, right now. But you guys have tried to do something about this. You've gone to the Congress, you've gone to legislators. What do you want to do?
We want to change the laws on a national level, change the drunk driving laws. And we have a list of points that we are pushing. And in the letter I wrote to all the U.S. senators and congressmen, their requirements, serious penalties, mandatory penalties for repeat drunk drivers.
Anne might have left something hugely important out, not meaning to, is that we're looking for uniform standards and laws that translate state to state.
Gotcha, because the states make the laws, but in the same way we have a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit or a 65-mile-an-hour limit, the feds come along and say, you don't get the money unless
you do this. I respect and appreciate states' rights, but not when it comes to interstate highways, roads that we share. Route 7 travels from Connecticut clear up to Vermont. We're all traveling on the same road, state to state.
Sure. Okay, very quickly then, Anne, because I know you've done a lot of work on this. What are some of the penalties or other things that you would do to put a stop to this kind of stuff?
Okay, I would say uniform definitions for DUI and simpler means of proving out-of-state prior offenses, impoundment of repeat offenders' vehicles, ignition interlock devices on all vehicles to which a driver would have access or indeed, maybe on all new cars.
So immediate impoundment. Now, you know, you think about something that simple. You get into a DWI. You've been in another DWI, whatever. Take the guy's vehicle away.
Yeah.
That's one of the things you do. Well, that's why I mentioned
how could he be driving the same vehicle that he crashed in Fishkill?
Right.
That just seems like common sense. Take the vehicle away, particularly given that it wasn't his vehicle to drive. That might be
so. It doesn't matter,
point.
Right?
It doesn't matter.
We don't care whose vehicle it was.
No, yeah. We don't care.
You
we just want to make sure that he doesn't have access to that vehicle or any vehicle.
Sure.
Some states are much tougher on drunk driving than others.
Which are the ones that you admire?
I think Maine and Georgia are very strict. And then in other countries, you have severe penalties. In Germany and Sweden, they don't tolerate drunk driving. And I think it's very important.
When you say they don't tolerate, how do they not tolerate?
Well, in Germany, one strike and you're out.
You lose your license.
You lose your license for the rest of your adult life. You're done. Sweden, other Scandinavian countries, I believe, have the same laws. Now, obviously, in these countries, they have adequate public transportation, something that is inadequate in my home area in the Berkshires for the most part. And a lot of exurban areas do not have adequate public transportation. You know, we are an automobile culture.
Well, tough. I mean, even so, you know, you do the crime, that's it.
You do the time, yeah.
Either the time or you don't get to drive another vehicle again.
That's right. That's right. I think, though, the reason I bring that up, and I think it's perhaps left for another conversation, is that many countries feel that it's, A, just inexcusable to drive drunk, but in their civilizations, they also have adequate public transportation. So if you get drunk, fine, get on the bus. Yeah. In our areas, we don't have those opportunities.
Well, we have some rudimentary.
I'm not trying to make excuses, but it does bring up bigger thinking.
Okay. And what's the response when you write these letters to these senators and congressmen? You know, I always worry about this drunk driving stuff with our legislators and others, because I think in the back of some people's minds, there but for the grace of God goes I, in terms of these penalties. A kid goes into a drugstore and holds it up, and, you know, he can be in jail for 10 years. Somebody wipes out somebody in an accident, kills somebody, yeah. And, you know, a slap on the hand, relative slap on the hand.
Well, I've had marginal responses from some courtesy letters. I had a great response from Congressman Alan West from Florida, and I was questioning him, how can we justify making these nationalized laws? You know, what right do we have to take the power away from the states of choosing their own drunk driving law penalties? And his comment was, well, when people are going across state lines, that's a national matter.
That's by the way, how we federalized health care, too.
And there's commerce, you know, the Commerce Committee, sure. The Judiciary Committee. So he was the first one who gave me some real channels through which to move forward on this.
Yeah. Ted, you mentioned before the idea of a civil suit. Have you guys filed a civil suit?
You know, I do want to segue. You asked Ann and I, you know, are we religious? We're both spiritual. I know that everyone has their own interpretation of what's spiritual is, but I'd like to think that there's more to our life than we can rationalize. And my daughter was tremendously spiritual in a lot of ways. I mean, she touched a lot of people's lives through her music, through her art, through her incredible scholastic abilities. And I went ahead and I looked up what her name meant, because I didn't know. And it's an old, very old Greek name that means fate or destiny and justice. And there were three aspects of her name that really struck me as the threat of life, the measure of the threat of life, and the severance of life. And at the time, that struck me as something very, very profound and ancient, that we are weaved into this life. We all have our allotted time, and then it's over. And my daughter, in just 24 years, touched a lot of people's lives. And it's probably what makes this so powerful, is it's compelling. Many families have lost children this way. And there's something we can do about it. It's called legislation. It is justice. This can change. You know, and my daughter had a galvanizing effect on the people that knew her. And I think Ann and I will never rest easy, but we're not going to rest until we galvanize some change in her name for other people who perhaps don't have to unnecessarily go through a death on the road that could have been prevented with proper interstate laws.
What you've just said really makes me think about people in our community in Great Barrington. I know that you farm lettuce, and I know that Michael Ballin and his restaurant uses those products. But he's really become committed to this thing, writes letters to the newspapers, makes it clear that, you know, he's watching every minute of, you know, of this. And he's not alone in this. And so I think your point is very well taken, that this has galvanized an awful lot of people to think about this. Yeah. I asked you about a civil suit.
The civil suit is in the process. I mean, I'd like the towns to answer some fundamental questions, like, where were you? This guy drove through a number of towns every day. He committed crimes in a number of the towns. I want all the records. I want to know what they knew about him and when they knew about him as well. I want answers from probation. You know, he racking up one offense after another, not fulfilling any of his obligations of probation. That should have immediately spurred jail time. He didn't go back to jail. If people had been doing their job, he would not have been on the road that night. So there are a number of civil actions that have been filed in the state of Connecticut.
Do you think, Anne, that there's any possibility that your good work with the Congress and congresspeople and senators will have any payoff? Or are you thinking that maybe, you know, this is in vain?
It's going to take a lot of work, and we're not going to give up. But, you know, you look at the world in general, there's a lot of horrible things that happen. And Ted got a letter from a grandfather of a girl named Melanie, who was the girl who spurred the passage of Melanie's Law in Massachusetts. And we know that he worked for a long, long time, many years, to push that through and is still trying to strengthen laws. So it's not...
Melanie's Law having to do with...
with drunk driving, in Massachusetts. And so I see it as a long path. Certainly Mothers Against Drunk Drivers has cared about this subject for a long, long time.
RID... yeah, same thing.
So we're not going to give up, and I think some change will occur, but you have to see it in perspective.
Mm. Your lives will never be the same.
No.
When you look at the future of our children, and then you see this guy in jail, you know, Ted, you're a better man than I. You are. Because when you were saying, look, he's got children, he's different, you know, he has his own story, none of us are perfect. My immediate reaction is, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
My reaction is, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't do the common things that...
I have both parts profoundly in me. I want to kill the guy. And the other part of me is I realize that we're all human beings. We're flawed people. But that's why we have a system of laws in our democracy, is so that we can curb, in a lot of cases, bad behavior, socially speaking. And I hold the system as much accountable for this guy's actions and continued perpetration. The system, which we have hired to enforce the laws, or the, you know, the various constables and people in the legal system, judicial system, they're there to protect and keep the peace. And in this case, they didn't do it. And there were many opportunities to do so. So I'm as furious with those in our system who didn't do their jobs. So my anger and frustration is not just focused on him. I've met a lot of people who've done some pretty rotten things in life, but I do believe in the human spirit. I do believe that in any given moment, we can turn something around in ourselves and make changes. We've got to believe that. But on the other hand, I don't want to see, I want to see this guy taken off the streets for a long time. He doesn't deserve the light of day and the freedoms. He abused his privilege of living in society free. So in that regard, I want to make sure justice is fulfilled this time around and that he goes to jail for a long time. Should have happened a long time ago. But, you know, you asked a profound question. You know, I realize he's a father. I don't know him. I don't want to know him. But there were people who knew him as a father who said some kind things, and that did affect me. You know, you've got children too.
You would never have driven a car under the influence repeatedly.
You know, many of us have driven intoxicated. This guy probably was seeing four roads in front of him. This was beyond drunk. This was a guy who clearly had no regard for other people, at least when he was in that state of mind. And he'd been in that state of mind on a number of occasions. So perhaps he's in a slightly different category of your, if there is an average drunk driver. But I think that's what we need to start addressing objectively is, when is too much alcohol too much? You know, if you know that the penalties are severe, maybe you're not going to have that third drink.
I tell you right now, I will not drink a glass of wine at a restaurant if I'm driving an automobile. So I think everybody else has different standards, you know, for this, because it's very worrisome. And in my case, I think I do it because it's right. I also think I understand that there are major consequences for misbehavior in life.
I think people need to have a rule that will catch them in their, you know, their drunk driving or whatever the problem is. We're not that good that we always self-monitor. But if we realize that a hefty jail term or the loss of a driver's license is going to be the consequence of driving drunk, then so be it.
I do want to tell you both how much I admire you. I know this is a difficult thing for you to do, and I can only say that we appreciate your coming in and sharing this with us, and there aren't any of us who can't relate to your story and to the way in which you're both doing this. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guests have been Ann Banks and Ted Dobson. You can learn more at Moira, M-O-I-R-A, memorial.org. Again, moiramemorial.org. Thank you all for joining us.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.